You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. The time now is 6 p.m.
It's Friday, February 13th. President Donald Trump talks up regime change in Iran as a good idea while deploying the country's largest aircraft carrier to the Middle East. This is world leaders gather for the Munich Security Conference, along with the son of the Shah of Iran, positioning himself as the opposition to Iran's theocratic leadership.
We have a plan before the regime's collapse and particularly for the transition after this regime.
A partial government shutdown. Lawmakers leave Capitol Hill without a deal to fund the Department of Homeland Security over immigration enforcement funding. This as Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem pivots to election security.
There is no room in our election system for people that aren't Americans.
Fueling further speculation as Democrats have warned the Trump administration will be sending immigration agents to the polls as a form of voter intimidation. And San Francisco school teachers end a five-day strike after the school district caves to their demands for better wages and fully funded health care.
We could not have done this alone. This is not a fight that happens just because educators think of taking on this kind of project. This is an entire collective power. This is an entire community.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Christina Onnestad. President Donald Trump beat the war drum today, speaking to the armed forces at Fort Bragg, the Army base in North Carolina named after a Confederate general. Trump warned, should Democrats win the midterms this November, they could force the name change as if it were a bad idea. He also met with military soldiers who carried out the president's plan to invade Venezuela and capture its president, Nicolas Maduro.
No other country on earth could have done what we did. No other country has the weapons. No other country has the skill. No other country has the guts. And no other country has the extraordinary warriors that we have. We have the best warriors in the world. Because you can have the greatest equipment, but if you don't have the warriors, the equipment doesn't mean much. Last month, we proved this truth once again when some of our greatest soldiers right here to ever live, frankly, successfully captured the outlaw dictator of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, and brought him back to face American justice where he's now right now waiting. And that was an amazing night.
He said the U.S. is investing $1 trillion in the military and building more ships. And he turned his attention to Iran after deploying the USS Gerald Ford, the world's largest aircraft carrier, from the Caribbean Sea to the Mideast to join other warships and military assets he's already deployed to the region.
We have a situation right now where we sent a very big carrier group to Iran. I'd love to see if we could make a deal. They've been difficult to make a deal. I thought we would have had a deal last time. They wish they did. And that's what we did, Midnight Hammer.
He's referring to the U.S. bombing of Iran last year. Speaking earlier in the day to reporters, he said regime change would be a good idea.
What can Iran do to avoid attack?
They give us the deal that they should have given us the first time. If they give us the right deal, we won't do that. But, you know, historically, they haven't done that.
I will say they want to talk, but so far they do a lot of talking and no action.
When are those talks, Mr. President?
They've already started.
Do you want regime change in Iran?
Well, it seems like that would be the best thing that could happen. In the meantime, we have tremendous power has arrived, and additional power, as you know, another carrier is going out shortly.
The comments come just days after Trump suggested another round of talks with Iran was at hand. The negotiations haven't materialized as one of Tehran's top security officials visited Oman and Qatar this week and exchanged messages with U.S. intermediaries. Trump is demanding Iran stop enriching uranium, which can be used to develop atomic weapons. But the Stockholm Institute of Peace reports enriched uranium at Iran's goal of 60% cannot be used to make a functional nuclear weapon. It notes, though, a 60% enriched uranium puts it closer to the 90% grade needed for a nuclear bomb. A nuclear deal with world leaders and Iran capped uranium enrichment at just under 4%. Trump withdrew from that agreement in 2018 during his first term in office. Iran then increased its uranium enrichment to 20%, now pursuing 60%. World leaders are gathering for the Munich Security Conference in Germany, where U.S. relations with European allies likely a contentious topic amidst President Trump's threats to take over Greenland from Denmark and his tariffs war. Secretary of State Marco Rubio to address the conference tomorrow, Saturday. He gave a hint of his presentation speaking to reporters.
The world is changing very fast right in front of us. The old world is gone, frankly, the world I grew up in, and we live in a new era in geopolitics, and it's going to require all of us to sort of re-examine what that looks like and what our role is going to be. And we've had many of these conversations in private with many of our allies, and they are our allies, and we need to continue to have those conversations, and I think Saturday, hopefully, and the meetings we'll have there will move us in that direction.
It's likely to further disrupt old alliances as European leaders are pushing transatlantic repair and trust. Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz today said the U.S. isn't powerful enough to go it alone in a world whose old order has withered. The leaders of France and Germany delivered sweeping criticisms of President Trump's treatment of the transatlantic alliance as they opened the Munich Security Conference, an annual gathering of top security figures around the globe. Max Pringle has more.
German Chancellor Friedrich Merz opened the Munich conference. He said through an interpreter that the post-World War II international order of rules and cooperation between countries has given way to big power politics.
Steht ein düsteres Motto.
You've chosen a grim motto for this conference, under destruction. And it probably means that the international order based on rights and rules is currently being destroyed. But I'm afraid we have to put it in even harsher terms. This order, as flawed as it has been even in its heyday, no longer exists.
French President Emmanuel Macron also addressed the topic of transatlantic cooperation. He said President Trump has taken the U.S. in a new direction, and Europe can no longer be dependent on it for its defense.
If we want to be taken seriously on the European continent and beyond, we must show the world our unwavering commitment to defend our own interests. It starts, of course, with continuing to extend our support to Ukraine, but it could nicely follow with fending off unjustified tariffs and politely declining unjustified claims on European territory. This is what we did, and this is what we will do.
U.S. political leaders were also on hand today. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke about the ongoing tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Speaking at a forum hosted by Politico, Pelosi said President Trump has made the world more dangerous by ripping up the non-proliferation treaty that the Obama administration worked out with Iran.
We all agree Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon.
Right.
What he did made it more possible for Iran to have
President
a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
And if Iran has a nuclear weapon, there'll be a proliferation of more countries in the region who want to have a nuclear weapon. So we all agree that they shouldn't have a nuclear weapon.
The topic of Ukraine and European security also came up. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said European countries are stepping up their military and technical assistance to Ukraine to help it defend itself against Russia's onslaught.
I think what Putin is scared of is the combination that the Europeans and the Americans are working together. And the good news is that under the leadership of the French and the British, this coalition of the willing came together to discuss security guarantees for post a peace deal to prevent ever Putin from attacking Ukraine again. And then the American President Trump, who broke the deadlock with Putin in February, starting the talks, came in August telling us, saying, hey, I want to be part of those security guarantees. We will help.
President Trump's recent threats to annex Greenland have put the Danish-controlled island territory on edge in recent weeks. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said, President Trump has been trying to ensure that Greenland is protected from threats by Russia and China.
The point is, Greenland is going to be more fortified,
right?
Because Donald Trump, once he feels like it's his brand or his some buy-in, is going to go big.
The conference also featured a panel on climate change. Governor Gavin Newsom talked about his recent trip to the COP climate summit in Brazil in November. He said the Trump administration was a no-show.
China sent close to 800 delegates. The United States didn't even send a stenographer. They sent nobody. They've completely walked away, abdicate any role in relationship to the issue of low carbon, green growth. President Xi is celebrating.
The Munich Security Summit will go through the weekend, ending this Sunday. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
At Munich, South Carolina, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham warned the Trump administration is in a precarious situation with Iran.
I've never seen a more consequential time in history as right now. If we can take this regime down through the people, their desires, not ours, and replace it with a friend, not a foe, be the biggest change in 1,000 years. If we don't get it right and we blink, it'll be the biggest change in 1,000 years in the wrong way.
He spoke on a panel with the son of the former Shah of Iran, who was overthrown. Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi has positioned himself as an opposition leader.
We have a plan before the regime's collapse, and particularly for the transition after this regime.
Pahlavi is in exile, living in the United States. U.S. Progressive Democratic Socialist Representative Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, also at the Munich Security Conference, speaking on a panel about wealth inequality. She warned about the failures in fueling authoritarianism.
One of the connections and relationships that is under-discussed, particularly in the security space, is the fact that I believe we're seeing an economy across economy around the world, including in the United States, that extreme levels of income inequality lead to social instability and drives, in a sense, in authoritarianism, right-wing populism, and very dangerous domestic internal politics. And that is a direct outcome of not just income inequality, but the failure of democracies over decades to deliver. The failure to deliver higher wages, the failure to rein in corporations.
Ocasio-Cortez cited free trade agreements like NAFTA and wars in the Middle East for the rise in wealth inequality.
There is a level of market concentration and corporate consolidation where a massive company can get so big that its consolidated power can rival that of nation states. And democracies, we have elected leaders. And in massive corporations that then begin to consume the public sector, gobble up the spending, they start to call the shots.
She urged a working class politics to counter the rise of movements like MAGA at home and abroad.
We have to have a working class centered politics if we are going to succeed, and also if we are going to stave off the scourges of authoritarianism, which also provides political siren calls to allure people into finding scapegoats to blame for rising economic inequality, both domestically and globally.
California Governor Gavin Newsom, who's positioning himself as the opposition to Trump's MAGA movement, also traveled to Munich, trolling the administration with a focus on climate policy.
Donald Trump is temporary. He'll be gone in 3 years. California is a stable and reliable partner in this space. And it's important for folks to understand the temporary nature of this current administration in relationship to the issue of climate change and climate policy.
The potential 2028 presidential candidate for Democrats blasted the Trump administration's ending of a 2009 government declaration known as the Endangerment Finding that determined carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases threaten public health and welfare. The Obama-era finding is the legal underpinning of nearly all climate regulations under the Clean Air Act for motor vehicles, power plants, and other pollution sources that are heating the planet, and the basis for tougher regulations on these industries for nearly two decades. The repeal eliminates greenhouse gas emission standards for cars and trucks and could unleash a broader undoing of climate regulations on power plants and oil and gas facilities. Legal challenges are near certain.
Donald Trump is doubling down on stupid. Never in the history of the United States of America has there been a more destructive president than the current occupant in the White House in Washington, D.C. He's trying to recreate the 19th century. He's a wholly owned subsidiary of big oil, gas, and coal. He's quite literally reopening coal plants in the United States of America. He's received close to $500 million in campaign contributions. He asked for $1 billion, look it up, in return for basically eliminating all regulations in the United States of America. De facto, he just did that yesterday with federal regulations and the endangerment finding. It is code red in terms of American leadership in this space.
While he's traveling in Europe, Newsom also plans to announce an economic agreement between California and representatives of Ukraine and regional leaders aimed at advancing cooperation on economic recovery, innovation, and resilience, according to his office. A larger point of travel is Newsom's continuing his effort to be recognized as Democrats' high-profile counter to the president, this time with a global emphasis, just weeks after a trip to participate in the World Economic Forum in Davos. Up next, South Carolina. In about a week, the state is vying to keep its spot as a key early presidential primary state in Democrats' 2028 nominating calendar. Public health advocates are condemning the Trump administration's move to end the regulation of greenhouse gas. More.
Laura Kate Bender with the American Lung Association says people across the U.S. will pay the price.
We know that climate change harms health. We know that vehicle standards protect health. And simply put, this repeal is going to harm people.
The White House calls the repeal the largest deregulatory action in American history and says it will provide needed relief to the U.S. auto industry. Maine Governor Janet Mills says the Trump administration is abandoning its responsibility to protect Americans from the proven harms of climate pollution. Maine is often referred to as the tailpipe of the nation, as wind currents bring air pollution from northeastern cities and midwestern coal plants to the state. Studies show Mainers have significantly higher rates of asthma, with some 22,000 children affected. Bender says eliminating emission standards will increase the impacts of climate change and the prevalence of lung disease.
When you breathe wildfire smoke blowing into the state, when you're experiencing more extreme heat, higher rates of things like Lyme disease than there used to be. All of that is bad for health, and all of that is driven in part by climate change.
Medium and heavy-duty vehicles, including trucks and buses, account for 10% of Maine's total greenhouse gas emissions, according to the governor's energy office. The Maine Climate Council has worked to lower those emissions and promote more electric vehicles to protect health and the environment. Bender says the American Lung Association, in partnership with other public health organizations, will challenge the EPA's repeal in court.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The Trump administration is urging other nations to press a tiny Pacific island of Vanuatu to withdraw a draft resolution before the United Nations supporting strong action to combat climate change, including reparations for damage caused by any nation that fails to take action. That's according to State Department guidance issued this week to all U.S. embassies and consulates abroad. The State Department said in the cable obtained by the Associated Press, if the proposal being discussed by the U.N. General Assembly is adopted, it could, quote, pose a major threat to U.S. industry, unquote. It's the latest move by the Trump administration to distance the U.S. from climate change efforts at home and around the world as it undoes domestic climate policy while reinvesting in the fossil fuel industry. A day ago, the government revoked the scientific finding that long has been the central basis for action to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Last month, the administration also announced plans to withdraw from the U.N. treaty that establishes international climate negotiations. The draft resolution sponsored by Vanuatu, which like many island nations fears for its survival because of climate change, is being circulated among 193 members in the General Assembly at the UN. It stems from a landmark advisory opinion by the United Nations top court last year, the International Court of Justice, which ruled countries could be in violation of international law if they fail to take measures to protect the planet from climate change, and nations harmed by its effects could be entitled to reparations. All UN member states, including major greenhouse emitters like the U.S. and China, are parties to the court. The opinion, not legally binding, but was hailed as a turning point in international climate law. The draft resolution from Vanuatu expresses determination to translate the ICJ's findings into, quote, concrete multinational action, unquote, and calls on all nations and organizations to comply with their obligations under international law related to climate change. The proposal says that includes adopting a national climate action plan to limit global temperature rise below 1.5 degrees Celsius, which scientists have cited as the temperatures needed to avoid catastrophic climate change. It also calls for phasing out subsidies for fossil fuel exploration, production, and exploitation, and urges those in violation to provide full and prompt reparation for damage. Vanuatu's UN ambassador said his island country wants a vote on the resolution by the end of March. You are listening to the Pacifica Evening News from KPFA, 94.1 FM, 89.3 FM in Berkeley, 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Christina Onnestad.
Is sending a love letter to our listeners, and we're hoping to receive one as well. KPFK exists because of the passion and the hearts of people like you. We don't have corporate sponsors, but we do have you, and that's fine by us. Keep the romance with independent media alive by making a donation today. Please call 818-985-5735 and press option 2 or visit kpfk.org/donate. Please give a gift from your heart and keep grassroots independent radio strong.
I came from Houston, Texas, moved out to L.A. for work and school. I found out about KPFK by turning on local radio, and it's nice to listen to the sister station out here.
KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Lawmakers left Capitol Hill today without a deal to fund the Department of Homeland Security over immigration enforcement funding. That's set to expire Saturday as lawmakers debate new restrictions on President Donald Trump's immigration enforcement agenda. Here's House Democrat Hakeem Jeffries.
Donald Trump and Republicans have decided that they have zero interest in getting ICE under control. The American people know ICE is out of control and that they need to be reined in. And Democrats are working hard to do just that. We believe that taxpayer dollars should be used to make life more affordable for everyday Americans, not brutalize or kill them.
Democrats say they won't help approve more funding until new restrictions are placed on federal immigration operations after the fatal shooting of ICU nurse Alex Preti and Renee Good in Minneapolis last month.
Our demand that the Fourth Amendment be respected, that judicial warrants be required before ICE agents can violently storm private property or the homes of the American people. That's completely and totally unacceptable. And yet Republicans refuse to adopt that.
Unlike the 43-day shutdown last fall, the closures will be narrowly confined, as only agencies under the Department of Homeland Security umbrella, like Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and CBP, Customs and Border Protection, will be affected. But how deeply they'll be affected is up for debate, since President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act that he signed into law last year includes a $75 billion additional infusion to the department. Still, depending on how long the shutdown lasts, some federal workers could begin to miss paychecks. Services like airport screening could also suffer if the shutdown drags on for weeks. At the Transportation Security Administration, 95% employees are deemed essential. That means they could continue to scan passengers and their bags at the nation's commercial airports, but they could end up working without pay until the funding lapse is resolved. Meanwhile, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is talking up the Republican election measure passed by the House of Representatives, the SAVE Act. And she says opponents are resorting to conspiracy theories because they want to cheat. She spoke at a news conference in Arizona where she said, "Your state has been an absolute disaster on elections." The next talking point she's pivoting to, Christopher Martinez reports.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem held a quickly planned news conference in Arizona Friday, but it was not on any of the big issues that have been dogging her lately: the immigration crackdown, fatal ICE shootings in Minneapolis, or the role of troops in law enforcement. She had a different topic in mind.
Since returning to office, President Trump has made election integrity a priority. He's made it a cornerstone of his Make America Great Again agenda. And the truth is that our election system needs a lot of work.
Elections are not usually a subject people think of when they think Homeland Security. According to the Constitution, states have the main role in organizing elections. But the Trump administration has been moving on a number of election fronts lately, from midterm redistricting to President Trump's comments on taking over elections in blue states. And now, Secretary Noem sees it as part of her job.
And although the Constitution gives states the primary responsibility for running their elections, Congress also gives authorities and duties to the federal government. Now, as the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, those authorities lie within my department, and the responsibility lies with me.
Noem stumped for the Save America Act that passed the House of Representatives last week and now faces a tough road in the Senate. The measure would impose proof of citizenship and voter ID requirements. Democrats and other advocates have blasted such requirements as voter suppression. But Noem dismisses those criticisms as conspiracy theories.
Each of the arguments that have been laid out to criticize this bill are baseless speculation from the radical left because they want illegal aliens to vote in our elections. They want to disenfranchise American citizens by telling them that their votes don't matter. There's only one reason that anyone would oppose this bill, and that's because they would want to cheat. They want illegal people and aliens in this country to be able to vote for them and to rob the United States citizens of their vote. And that's why they resist us at every single level when we're trying to deport people back to their home countries or stop them from committing crimes against the American people. That's why they do not support voter ID, proof of U.S. citizenship, or clean voter rolls.
Noem's news conference was hastily scheduled and kind of secretive. Journalists were told to report to an office in Phoenix, then shuttled in unmarked vans to a location in Scottsdale. Arizona has been a target of the administration, which is suing to get access to its voter rolls, along with 14 other states and the District of Columbia. Noam had some thoughts on Arizona's elections.
Your state has been an absolute disaster on elections, that your leaders have failed you dramatically by not having systems that work, by disenfranchising Americans who wanted to vote, that had to stand in lines for hours because machines failed or software failed. There's no state that could use more improvement than Arizona.
The news conference came just hours before Noam's Department of Homeland Security was to run out of funding in a partial government shutdown. Noam did not mention that directly, though it may have been on her mind as she referred to the Revolutionary War era.
The Continental Army went for years without being paid, and they braved through the brittle winter at Valley Forge as well. They did all of this because they wanted to ensure that their people, their families, and that their descendants could continue to live freely and could govern freely. If we don't uphold this bedrock principle of representative government, then our nation's choices will be decided by illegal aliens, by criminals, by foreign actors, and people that don't support America being the greatest country in the world.
Noam began her news conference with another historical anecdote, quoting the story of a woman who asked Benjamin Franklin what kind of government we would have. And he replied, "A republic, ma'am, if we can keep it." But Democrats see the Republican election moves as the real threat to the republic. Democratic Congressmember Joe Morelli of New York blasted Republican election legislation at a committee hearing earlier this week.
Redrawing congressional lines to make them better for Republicans, changing the rules of elections, brutalizing American citizens who exercise their rights under the U.S. Constitution. This scheme is not just how Republicans plan to take over our elections, it's how they plan to take over our country.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Todd Lyons said today his agencies opened a joint probe with the Justice Department after a video evidence reveals sworn testimony provided by two separate officers appeared to have made untruthful statements about the shooting of a Venezuelan man in Minneapolis last month. The announcement comes as a federal judge ordered all charges dropped against Julio Cesar Sosa Celis, who was shot in the leg by an immigration officer, as well as another Venezuelan man, Alfredo Alejandro Arriona. The officers who were not named have been placed on administrative leave pending completion of an internal investigation, Lyons said. He also said lying under oath is a serious federal offense, adding the U.S. Attorney's Office is actively investigating. The Trump administration has ended temporary protected status, TPS, for immigrants from Yemen. The policy had allowed more than 1,300 nationals of Yemen to live and work in the U.S. for more than a decade. The decision announced today by the Department of Homeland Security comes as the White House moves to put more immigrants in the U.S. eligible for deportation. It represents another step to not only reverse the Biden administration's expansion of TPS, but to end it to countries that had long had it. Yemen is the latest in a string of nations to lose temporary protected status, including Venezuela, Honduras, Haiti, Nicaragua, Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, Nepal, Cameroon, and Ethiopia. During the Biden administration, more than 1 million people were protected by TPS. The Department of Homeland Security said conditions in Yemen have improved and no longer pose a serious threat to the safety of returning Yemeni nationals. Yemen was initially designated for TPS status in 2015, a decade ago, based on an ongoing armed conflict. Yemen nationally in the U.S., with no other lawful status, have 60 days to voluntarily leave the country after the TPS termination notice is published in the Federal Register, according to the Department of Homeland Security. That termination could be challenged in court. The Trump administration is suing Harvard University, saying it has refused to provide admissions records that the Justice Department demanded to ensure the Ivy League school stopped using affirmative action in its admissions process. A lawsuit filed today in federal court in Massachusetts said Harvard has thwarted efforts to investigate potential discrimination. It accused the university of refusing to comply with a Justice Department investigation and asks a judge to order the university to turn over the records. Harvard said it's in compliance with the law. It's the latest salvo in President Trump's standoff with Harvard, which has faced massive funding cuts after it rejected demands from the administration. Trump officials have said they're taking action against Harvard over allegations of anti-Jewish bias on campus. Harvard officials say they're facing unconstitutional retaliation for refusing to adopt the administration's ideological views. The administration's appealing a judge's order that sided with Harvard in two lawsuits. And the department opened a compliance review into Harvard's admissions practices last April. The same day, the White House issued a series of sweeping demands aligned with Trump's priorities. The agency told Harvard to hand over 5 years of admissions data for undergraduate applications, along with the school's medical and law schools. It asked for a trove of data, including applicants' grades, test scores, essays, extracurricular activities, and admissions outcomes, along with their race and ethnicity. It asked for the data by April of 2025. The lawsuit said Harvard has not provided that data. After 4 days on the picket lines, San Francisco teachers ended their first strike in nearly 50 years early this morning and announced a major win for the bargaining team. Higher wages they were on the picket line for and fully funded health care. Cassandra Curiel is president of the teachers' union, UESF, United Educators of San Francisco.
We negotiated all through the night. We reached an agreement at 5:30 in the morning that met the needs of our entire community. We got fully funded health care. We got wage improvements. We got sanctuary cities, protections from AI, contracting out, special education improvements for our working conditions, and a whole slew of other things. It was really important, though, to note that, like, we could not have done this alone.
Teachers hit the picket lines Monday after 11 months of negotiations without a deal. Parents, students, and other unionized school workers rallied in their support, thousands marching, rallying over the last 4 days, and celebrating at a rally in Dolores Park today. Natalie Creasy is a union's vice president of substitutes, and on the bargaining team, she spoke this morning.
The fact that we will now have fully funded health benefits from employee only to family by 2027 is a historic victory. Our paraeducators who make very little money were paying $1,500 a month. By January of 2027, they will be paying nothing. And in the meantime, there will be relief for those who were paying. They will go down 50% starting in July. It's a huge victory.
Certified employees, including teachers, will receive 2% raises this year and next, and additional paid work days to their calendar. UESF said the certified package totals 5% over 2 years. Classified employees, including paraeducators, will receive raises totaling 8.5% over 2 years, 4% the first year, 4.5% in the second, along with an additional floating holiday. Paraeducators providing specialized medical services will receive an additional ongoing 5% salary increase. The two-year agreement still needs to be signed by union members and the school district. San Francisco Superintendent Maria Sue spoke at a separate press conference this morning.
This is historic. This is how we continue to value not only our students, but also our educators. And this is how we use This is how we are creative in using restricted sources, because we are using a special parcel tax to be able to fund those health benefits.
The school district says it faces a $102 million deficit. And today, Sue didn't rule out cuts, school closures, or school consolidation down the road when asked by a reporter.
No layoffs or school closures.
It's always been on the table.
It won't happen. We'll fight it. There are ways to increase revenue to our district, and we'll stand with them now. This fight is over for now. We can stand together. Cuts, they choose division against us and our families.
Sue also urged new funding mechanisms at the state level to help secure more robust funding for schools. Currently, funding is based on how many students attend classes each day. Sue says it's time that changes.
Because a student who doesn't show up that day doesn't mean that we do not need to pay for a teacher that day. Doesn't mean that we do not need to have the social worker there that day or the custodian there that day. We still do. And so therefore the formula needs to reflect the number of students that we have in total as opposed to the number of students that we have that day. The other request that I've made is for the state to consider a change in the way we calculate poverty in large urban cities. Because our poverty level in San Francisco is very, very different from some of our neighboring cities and towns.
Meanwhile, roughly 49,000 students in San Francisco will return to their classrooms Wednesday next week, after the President's Day and Lunar New Year holidays. California's first-of-its-kind CareCourt program remains controversial for years after it was first launched as a pilot program in select counties. It's since become state law, allowing a judge to order select individuals experiencing homelessness and mental health struggles to receive treatment. But some say the court lacks resources, has a high rate of case dismissals, and isn't delivering the promise for families seeking help for struggling loved ones. Support was split initially for CareCourt among advocates, civil rights groups concerned ordering a person to treatment would violate their rights to informed consent. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, supported the civil court system, citing struggles to get loved ones the care to stabilize. KPFA's health and well-being reporter Annetta Felix takes a closer look how CareCourt is actually working in the state.
When California lawmakers passed the CARE Act in 2022, it was sold as a first-of-its-kind approach to treat people with severe mental illness. Families like June Dudas, who lives in San Diego, saw CareCourt as the last hope to get help for her cousin, Ed, who suffers from bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and anosognosia.
I thought we finally had a path to recovery for him and a path to some peace for my aunt. She's 84 years old, and Ed has voices that tell him to kill her, and he's tried in the past. So I really thought when the county crisis line told me that this program existed and that it could force him into treatment, it was the first hope we had in a long time.
Dudas petitioned the court to get her cousin help, and Ed met the requirements to get into court-ordered treatment. But despite that, he could not get the care he needed.
When they told me that he met all of the criteria, but then they couldn't enroll him in the program, I was just boggled. The problem for my cousin has been every time I've called 911, and he violated the restraining order against his mother last year 21 times, every time I called 911, I explained the situation to them and I said, you need to have somebody come out from the PERT team. He's a danger to himself. He's a danger to others. He's, you know, mentally ill, all of these things. And every time they would show up and say, we didn't have the resources, they didn't come.
For Dudas, the lack of resources coupled with the voluntary participation requirement in CareCourt are hindrances to its success.
In his mind, he is not sick. The last time that the county clinician met with him, he said that it's my aunt and I that are mentally ill, that he's perfectly fine and we should be the ones getting treatment.
Their case was ultimately dismissed because her cousin wouldn't participate. Dodas's struggle reflects a growing setback about the program, a higher rate of petition dismissals. According to the 2025 CARE Act annual report, 377 petitions were dismissed in the first 9 months of the program. The Judicial Council of California data shows nearly half the petitions were dismissed, a total of 1,338 out of 2,873 petitions. Between the years 2023 to 2025, the CARE Act annual report says some petitions were dismissed at the judge's discretion. Others did not meet the eligibility criteria, and others simply chose not to participate. To dig into this, KPFA reached out to administrators of CARE Court across several counties in California. One of them was Jay Africa, Director of Behavioral Health in San Mateo.
There are many reasons why people don't want treatment. They don't think they need it. They don't have time. Even if it goes through in the court, if they don't show up to treatment, there's no like punishment. So I see it as a tool because it's really, at the end of the day, voluntary.
Participating in CARE Court begins with a petition filed by a family member, a provider, or the individual themselves. A judge reviews it to see if it meets the criteria. And if the judge agrees, outreach teams are dispatched within as little as 48 hours. Finding a person who's homeless and mentally ill is another setback. Kate Jones, who represents Alameda County and the Behavioral Health Department, says there are multiple barriers to CARE Court success. She facilitates the program and liaises with the petitioners and the court.
Individuals can be extremely hard to find. Our team is everywhere. They are all over the county. They are on railroad tracks. They are looking everywhere for individuals that are respondents to petitions. The other reason is it is a voluntary program, so people must agree to participate in this program. Another reason is because they're engaging in treatment with another provider.
Jones says the quickest they've gotten a petition filed and the participant enrolled in CARE Court is 30 days. But based on their willingness to participate, the longest took almost a year. Alameda County's CARE Court is just over 1 year old.
There is an instance where it took us almost the entire first year of CARE Court to engage someone. She is now on the full service partnership. The team was there engaging with her to get her into services and stable. And that took literally 11 months.
Advocates like Jennifer Friedenbach, Executive Director of the Coalition on Homelessness, argue that CARE Court is taking the wrong approach by prioritizing legal intervention over housing and direct treatment.
We have a huge shortage of mental health care in the community. And because of that shortage, we have an over-reliance on locked facilities and dragging people with mental illnesses through court. This ends up wasting a lot of money on court costs that could be spent on expanding the system to serve the needs of people with mental illnesses in a much more effective way.
Friedenbach imagines a world where homeless people and those with mental health challenges get the care they need without legal burdens.
If I had a magic wand and I was building the system myself, I wouldn't have an extra layer of court reliance. I would rebuild our boarding cares, ensure that we had treatment that wasn't just mental health treatment available on demand, but substance use treatment simultaneously on demand, including medically assisted treatment. I would make sure that people had access to trauma therapy, which right now only affluent people do, and get folks stabilized.
Despite criticism about the low approval rates for CARE Court statewide, Jones says CARE Court is helping people in Alameda County.
We've worked with 187 individuals that are unhoused out of 232 petitions. So that tells us a vast majority of individuals are in fact unhoused that are being referred to CARE. If you were to take the dismissals out of the picture, we have an engagement rate that's about 65% of individuals, anywhere between 65 to 70%, are saying yes to services.
KPFA could not connect with successful care court petitioners, but Jones offers a success story from the program.
I was thinking of our gentleman who really wanted to work in a bike shop, and he is now working in a bike shop and is in temporary housing and very happy.
In San Diego, Judas is still hoping for her own success story with care court. But until that happens, she's taking matters into her own hands to keep her aunt safe from Ed, who's due to be released from jail in March, after being arrested for making an attempt on the aunt's life.
We've installed four different security cameras on my aunt's Section 8 bungalow. Because I've gotten nowhere with the care court petitions, my aunt will lock herself in her bathroom every time he shows up because he's threatened to smash in her window. I invested probably 1,000 hours in the last year trying to do something to protect them both. And I've gotten really nowhere.
As of January 1st, 2026, Senate Bill 823 expanded the eligibility for care court to include individuals with bipolar disorder and psychotic features. This change was designed to address the thousands of Californians who previously fell through the cracks of the system.
This is Chris Hedges, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, heard globally at kpfk.org.
This is Maggie LaPique.
And I'm Gary Baca for KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
During our winter fun drive, we are honoring Black History Month by celebrating the voices that have historically challenged power and demanded justice. From the roots of civil rights to the contemporary fight for liberation, KPFK remains dedicated to amplifying Black brilliance and resistance. But we can't do this work without your support. Your donation keeps independent, community-funded media alive. Please make a donation today at kpfk.org/donate or call us right now, 818-985-5735, press option 2. Support Black history, support independent media, support KPFK.
Our winter fun drive continues until March 6th. Join KPFK 90.7 FM for our winter fun drive. As a listener-supported platform, we remain one of the few places on the dial where the airwaves belong to the people, not corporations. In honor of Black History Month Centennial, we are featuring the profound insights and historical recordings of the giants who shook the foundations of injustice, including James Baldwin, Malcolm X, Angela Davis, Dr. Cornel West, and so many others from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Your contribution keeps our independent voice alive and preserves these revolutionary voices for the next generation. The number to call is 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online anytime at kpfk.org/donate. Donate today and let your voice be heard. Today, in 2026, we mark a full century of this vital work. What began as a week of learning in segregated schoolhouses has grown into a global month-long celebration of brilliance and resilience.
The 2026 centennial theme is a century of Black history commemorations, reflecting on how these moments have shaped our national identity. This collection features historic programming from all five Pacifica sister stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, and Pacifica National Specials, celebrating 100 years of Black History Month. Black History Month Centennial Collection comes as an 8-gigabyte jump drive, or we can email downloadable files. That's a $150 donation. Put that on your Visa, MasterCard, American Express. Call now, 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online at kpfk.org/donate. Our flagship collection is the Black History Month Centennial Collection. 72 programs, 85 hours from all five Pacifica stations, and you hear the voices, as Gary said, of Malcolm X, Angela Davis, James Baldwin, Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, Black history and the voices of the people who made it. Gary, let's take a listen to an excerpt from A Talk from James Baldwin, Harlem, 1963. He's standing in a room full of people 3 months before the March on Washington, and he's about to rewrite the founding myth of this country in just about 2 minutes. Listen to who he says really built America.
Before
This country was established when the country was being established. And this, apart from what one's textbooks say, and in contradistinction to the television myths about the building, the discovery of America, the people who came to America, as it turns out, were neither heroes, saints, nor pilgrims. They were simply people who couldn't make it where they were. And that is why they came. They came here to make, as we like to say, a better life for themselves and their children. And as it turned out, and as it always does indeed turn out, what they meant by a better life for themselves and their children was the opportunity to make more money and oppress somebody else. Which is what they did. The Indians have vanished, except for those we have under protective custody. And in order to build the country, it was necessary to find a source of cheap labor. And therefore, 400 years later, I represent the only man who never wanted to come here.
James Baldwin, 1963.
A part of your Black History Month centennial collection.
That recording has been in the Pacifica Vault for 60 years. The Black History Month Centennial Collection has 72 recordings like that. 85 hours, voices you cannot hear anywhere else. It's a $150 pledge to KPFK or $25 a month. Call us now, 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online, kpfk.org/donate. To secure the future of independent, community-powered radio at KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, we are celebrating 100 years of intentional Black History commemorations, a movement that began as Negro History Week in February 1926 and has grown into a global observation. A century of Black History commemorations focusing on the historical origins, evolution, and enduring significance of these remembrances. As part of the Pacifica Foundation, KPFK remains one of the few platforms dedicated to the unseen and unheard stories of the Black diaspora. From local grassroots activism to global cultural impact, we need to remind you that KPFK provides accurate, inclusive history at a time when curriculum debates and book bans are challenging the preservation of African American narratives. Please help us fund the station's winter operations to ensure these vital programs continue through the spring.
Hey, Maggie, so KPFK is powered by the people. That's you. Call now, 818-985-5735, or pledge securely online at kpfk.org/donate. We encourage listeners to become sustainers to provide a stable foundation for the station's future for as little as $5 a month. How about $10, $15, $20, $25 per month? Also donate online anytime at kpfk.org/donate or call in 818-985-5735, option 2.
We need you, folks. This is People Powered. That means you. Call us right now, 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online, kpfk.org/donate. Thank you so much.
I came from Houston, Texas, moved out to L.A. for work and school. I found out about KPFK by turning on local radio, and it's nice to listen to the sister station out here.
This February, KPFK is sending a love letter to our listeners, and we're hoping to receive one as well. KPFK exists because of the passion and the hearts of people like you. We don't have corporate sponsors.
But we do have you, and that's fine by us. Keep the romance with independent media alive by making a donation today. Please call 818-985-5735 and press option 2 or visit kpfk.org/donate. Please give a gift from your heart and keep grassroots independent radio strong.
Tune in for some fresh raps and classic cuts right here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and beyond on some breakbeats and rhymes.
Breakbeats and rhymes. Big things, baby, yo.
Breakbeats and rhymes radio.
Hey, yo, yo, y'all can't stand right here. In his right hand was your man's worst nightmare. Loud enough to burst his right eardrum close range. The game is not only dangerous, but it's most...